Welcome to Business Infrastructure, the podcast about curing back office blues of fast-growing businesses. If you're a business owner or operator looking for practical tips and solutions to scaling your business in a sustainable manner, you're in the right place. Now here's your hostess, Alicia Butler-Pierre.
Hello and welcome to the Business Infrastructure Curing Back Office Blues show. I'm your hostess, Alicia Butler-Pierre, and I'm joined today by a VIP guest, Mr. Ron Carucci. Ron is co-founder and managing partner at Navilent, working with CEOs and executives pursuing transformational change for their organizations, leaders, and industries. He has a 30-year track record helping executives tackle challenges of strategy, organization, and leadership from startups to Fortune 10s, nonprofits to heads of state, turnarounds to new markets and strategies, overhauling leadership and culture to redesigning for growth. Ron has helped organizations articulate strategies that lead to accelerated growth and has designed organizations that can execute those strategies. He has worked in more than 25 countries on 4 continents, and he's the author of 8 books, including the recent Amazon number 1, Rising to Power. Ron is a regular contributor to the Harvard Business Review, where Navilent's work on leadership was named one of 2016's Management Ideas That Mattered Most. He's also a regular contributor to Forbes and a 2-time TEDx speaker. His work has been featured in Fortune, CEO Magazine, Inc., Business Insider, MSNBC, Business Week, Smart Business, and Thought Leaders. Now you know why I call Ron a VIP guest. Very impressive bio. And today Ron is actually going to share with us how he used organization design tools to drive innovation and quickly bring new products to market. So without any further ado, Ron, welcome to the show. It is truly an honor. How are you today?
I'm great, Alicia. Thanks so much for having me. That's very kind. It's glad to be here.
Very impressive background. Can you tell us more about what you do at your company, Navilent?
So we spend our days talking with all kinds of leaders and organizations, mostly leaders who have some strategic aspiration to get somewhere else, or maybe leaders that got themselves stuck in a ditch of some kind. But for some reason, there's a major change in front of them that they are struggling to get after. And so they call us to help them uncover what could be going wrong and why they might be stuck, or why the aspiration they want might be a little bit out of reach, and then how to craft a pathway to get where they want to go.
Okay, and so I'm sure that could cover all kinds of different areas of the business, right?
From it could be strategy. Either they don't have one, or they don't know what it is, or there's too many versions of it.
Okay.
It could be cultural, where they've got behaviors in the organization that they're not quite understanding why people are choosing to behave the way they are, or not choosing to behave the way they want them to. It could be a market shift, a competitor's done something strange or weird or a new regulatory requirement of them, some externally imposed thing. It's a variety of forces that put pressure on businesses, especially small businesses, where the owners or founders are typically so busy working in the business that they have no time to work on the business.
Absolutely.
And so the opportunity to scale and really think about the long-term health of the business, is often taken away by the fact that they've got immediate fires to put out.
Yes, and so when you mentioned that there's a major change approaching, do you find that sometimes you actually might suggest the introduction of a new product or a new service for a client like that?
Well, sometimes that is the reason they call. They've decided to enter a new market or offer something different to a customer base, or to try and go after a different customer with what they serve. Now, they've made some decision about their relationship to their marketplace and their customer that they're trying to execute. A lot of times what we find is that the decision was ill-founded, meaning they made assumptions that were not well-founded about their product. Or the decision was a good decision to go after a certain customer, but the way they did it didn't work. right? So there's a variety of problems and that can go sideways. And usually people get very excited about, you know, when they, especially if they've been successful, if you've actually got commercialized something very effectively once or twice before, you think you have this halo effect and the market's rewarding you. So you get careless, you get complacent, you get a little arrogant. And then suddenly you find yourself scratching your head as to why it is now a product isn't working. Mm. And then if you dig up underneath it, you find that your motivations were, you know, financially driven or some other driver. You skip steps, you skip quality steps, you didn't get good enough consumer data. You know, for some reason, you shortcutted this and you need to be honest about that.
Hmm. Can you share an example with us of a specific time when you were able to help a client drive innovation to quickly bring a new product to the market? Once you've assessed the fact that it is in fact a good idea to introduce a new product to the
sure.
market.
Sure. Well, I think the word I'd want to qualify, Alicia, is quickly.
Okay.
Because, you know, we all want to, you know, we get ideas and then we get impulsive, we get reactionary, or we get anxious, mm-hmm. and we don't think about what it means to commercialize something for the long term. You know, a lot of times our near-term motivational our innovation goals are motivated by we have a hole in our P&L for the year, or we have a region that's underperforming, and so we want to use innovation or product extensions as a way to plug a hole in a financial problem. Sometimes that can work, but a lot of times it's just masking a problem. Mm. And we're just playing a little bit of a shell game with our products or our services to try and game the marketplace. But people typically see through it, and it doesn't usually go well. Innovation has to be driven by a very clear identified need that no one else is meeting or that you can meet better than somebody else. We all get wrapped up in our own ideas. We all get enamored with our own creativity and brilliance and assume the rest of the world will follow suit. But yeah. that isn't always the case. It's a, you know, it doesn't matter what you're doing out there. Someone else is doing it. There may be a lot of people doing it, and they may be right down the street. So these days, to differentiate yourself and your offerings to the people who you want to pay for it really takes a lot of thought and sometimes some luck. But a lot of careful study of the people you want to pay for it to make sure they in fact will pay you for what it is you're gonna bring to market. So, a beverage company that I work with was very very it was adult beverages, and they had been very very successful in a couple of different categories. The owner of the company and his team were very innovative in flavors. Very innovative in packaging, very innovative in how they created their product and how they brewed their product and how they fermented their products and how they locally sourced the ingredients. They did some great work in branding. And they decided they wanted to enter a third category, having been successful in two others, especially while they're successful in one of them. They rushed. They didn't do enough product testing. They didn't do enough product quality. It was a category that was growing, so they should have had their fair share of that growth, but they had major branding issues, major product quality recall issues, not once but twice. Admittedly, they did it. It was financially motivated. It was not for the love or joy of the product or wanting to be in the category or wanting to bring a new set of offerings to customers who are already loyal to their brands. It was just simply financially motivated. And the sad thing is that the category is one they should be in. The category is one that does have room for new entrants and will tolerate innovation and creativity, and they probably could participate in very, very well. But they have to go back and redo the steps they skipped in terms of quality, packaging, branding, flavoring, tastes, and really understanding who's the buyer for this product. So they're in the process of going back and doing that now, and I hope they can recover. And they got a little bit of egg on their face from a couple of bad missteps, wow. And they now know what they need to do to go redo that. But many organizations, especially small businesses, when they've got it's an idea looking for a consumer, People get too Steve Jobs addicted when they think, you know, Steve Jobs said nobody asked for an iPod.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really typically, that's a rare exception, right? For the most part, whether you're in food and beverage or electronics or apps or some type of professional services or some type of combination of technology and ideas, or personal development, somebody else is likely doing something close to it. And so really finding out what will set you apart, what the people who you want to pay you really, really want, and listening to them and hearing from them how they're describing the problem. The classic test and learn fast, bring something that you starts that, you get a minimal viable product or service that they can use and see how they metabolize it and continue to refine it very quickly. That's for small businesses. That's the most cost-effective way to bring something to market, is to make sure you've grounded it in the lives and minds of those you want to pay for it, and even so much as making sure you are seen doing that, right? So nothing builds credibility faster for prospective buyers than to see you really caring about their needs and wants, but by hanging out with and listening to the people who are helping to shape your offering. People will pay attention to that. If it looks like, your product looking for a market, are you trying to sell something? We all of us get barraged all day long with advertisement and social media ads and people trying to, we all get creeped out when we go on Amazon search for something and suddenly that thing is in our Facebook feed.
Mm-hmm.
So buyers are wary. Buyers are cautioned. They expect, sometimes the relationship between a buyer and a seller starts with distrust. Even if I have a legitimately expressed need for something I'm looking for, I'm skeptical. And so I just was on Amazon this morning and I was looking for a particular type of skincare for guys. And of course, if you put in that in the search bar, you'll get 10 pages of every type of product there is, from price ranging from $12 to $180. And I'm like, how do I pick? These all look like small companies or medium-sized companies. They all look like they have great brands or similar ingredients. On what basis would I choose from the seller who's sitting somewhere in some town, somewhere in the United States or across the ocean, wanting to send me that product? How would I make my decision? And that's the challenge for small businesses today is because they're virtual, people are buying their products from a variety, unless you're in a restaurant business where you really are a local business, in which case, that's a whole other different set of work to understand how you choose your location or the real estate, how you choose the what type of cuisine to be in or what need to meet or what price range to be in. Now I've understood from restaurateurs, one of the biggest challenges is which apps to associate with in terms of reservations and which ones not to, right? There are 10 apps out there like OpenTable that will help link, diners to you, each requiring a different set of complexities. And suddenly restaurateurs are having to figure out how do I even know which ones to associate with and not? So there's so many complex choices for small businesses to make between the time they are commercializing something and the time they're successful at it. And you just can't skip those steps, right? That's the big challenge. You just can't skip the process. You've got to be thorough. And it's a very, very long-winded answer to your question, but thoughtfulness and preparation and data, I think, are the key.
And, I can't help but think of actually, two things came to mind as I was listening to you share that example, and that was a really great example. One, I actually watched something fairly recently. I think it was on PBS Frontline. It was a two-part special on Facebook, and they were kind of taking a tour through, I think, one of their original locations, and they had these quotes painted on different walls throughout the building, and one of them was fail fast, and they were saying that's kind of a mantra throughout Silicon Valley. So I'm curious to know what your thoughts about failing fast is. And then also, there are a lot of people who tell us as small business owners and entrepreneurs, it doesn't have to be perfect. Ron, just get it out there. It doesn't have to be perfect. You can fix it along the way. But at what point do you, it's such a tough thing to know, because we don't want to make a huge mistake where someone could potentially die or get seriously injured, or we want the product or our service to be as it is described. And as small business owners, we can't afford to the legal repercussions.
Right.
So I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about those two things, failing fast and, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Alicia, I love the question, because I was just, the other day, a client of mine said he used the quote, you know, perfect is the enemy of good enough.
Mm.
And I said, yeah, but good enough is the enemy of survival, because good enough can often be mediocre.
Yeah.
So what, you know, defining honestly, what does good enough really mean? Yes, there are people out there for whom perfectionism is a disease, and it paralyzes them in action because of a fear of failure. That's an extreme we don't want to go to. But on the other end, you know, trying to fool your customer, oh, they'll never know the difference, or it's good enough, or it's fine. If you sound like you're trying to convince yourself that the offering itself will be okay, that should be a red flag.
Mm.
Because if you don't know, it means you haven't actually seen one of your customers use it. You haven't tested it. You haven't put it in front of a set of people to say, hey, try this. What do you think? And gotten feedback. Fail fast doesn't mean spray and pray, right? Fail fast doesn't mean cross your fingers and hope for the best. It means take your offering to your target consumer in a controlled experimental environment and watch them consume it and use it. Watch them try and wrestle with it. Let them give you feedback. Let them kick the tires on it. Let them criticize it till you want to cry. Then go back and refine it. Then bring it out again. And maybe by a third time, it's ready for prime time and broad use. Minimal viable product doesn't mean the least you can spend and get away with, right? It means the least you can do that will satisfy your customers in a way they'll want to pay for it. And those are not the same thing.
Yeah, and I think that's where we can easily get ourselves into trouble, is especially if we don't adhere to what you were saying, you know, making these decisions, these are financially motivated decisions, and we're thinking, oh my gosh, cash flow is stagnant, we need to get some money in here quick, fast, and in a hurry, so let's just put it out there. So, yep. I really appreciate you really taking a deep dive into providing an answer on those two things. So going,
and you know, Alicia, it's what I would tell you, I mean, there are times where our businesses struggle, right? There, we do have an issue around cash flow. Our pipelines are thin, margins are thin. You know, a cost structure may be out of balance between some, we made some assumptions about revenue that didn't come true. And so we do need to act, right? We can't ignore that. We do need to act. So I think it's a really fair question for a small business owner to say, what can innovation do for me there?
Yeah.
I think you can be innovative in how you offer promotions. You can be innovative with how you, you know, give stuff away for free, attract new customers with offers of, you know, how you give them an option to sample what you offer. So there are ways you can be creative and innovative in how you grow your top line performance, or how you attract customers who don't know who you are. You just can't make it a ruse, right? You can't try and sort of, you know, create the illusion of a big launch of a new product, but that's really not one.
Mm. Well said. Now, going back to that example that you shared with us about the adult beverage company, can you talk to us a little bit more, Ron, about some of the specific people that you worked with to help them turn things around, maybe some of the processes that you use, and any tools that you may have used, whether it be a certain type of checklist or methodology or books or classes, things of that nature?
So the first thing I'll start with for any small business is the issue of identity strategy. Whenever I ask a small business owner to tell me their strategy, it's interesting how many counterfeits I get. I get a mission statement or a vision statement, or I get the product quota, or I get Costco called and placed an order, that's the strategy. Or I get, this is what the salesperson is selling or the sales force is selling, that's my strategy. But, you know, or I get the goals for the year. And I tell them that's all very interesting, but that doesn't tell me who you are. Mm-hmm. Tell me why somebody looking for what you do would pick you over two or three other people who are offering the same thing. Because if you can't tell me on what basis you differentiate, is it service? Is it creativity? Is it accessibility? Is it convenience? Is it price? Is it depth and breadth? Is it assortment? There are reasons, especially if you're in a business that's rather, you know, like you're in dry cleaning, or you're in restaurateuring, or you sell skincare products. You know, it could be a variety of businesses, but if there are lots of other people doing it, differentiation is that much more important, to be very clear, because until you tell me what you're saying no to, you have no strategy. I have to know what you're turning away to focus on who you are and who you want to become in the marketplace. I also have to know on what basis you've chosen that. What customers would tell you, what evidence do you have that there are customers who will pay that price for what you offer and they want it in that way? You can't just be guessing. And it can't be, you know, the plural of anecdote is not data. Two people called last week asking, so there's a market opportunity. Mm-hmm. Right? You have to have, so let's assume now we've solved for identity. You can tell me the two or three bases on which you want to differentiate yourself, and you can tell me the capabilities you have to be good at to differentiate yourself that way. And you can show me how you've invested in those capabilities, whether it's service or quality or creativity or assortment or convenience, whatever. Now we have to step back and look at the work of your organization, because so many small businesses get very confused and they want to create a culture of egalitarianism. They want to create a culture that people feel welcomed and all part of a team. And whether you have, you know, 20 employees or 100 employees, the true reality is that not all work is created equal. Sure, you can treat all people equally, but all of the work you do in your company is not the same. And too many leaders just peanut butter their resources across that work as if it was. So the tool we use to categorize work separates work into three categories. The first category is your competitive work. What's the work you do that directly contributes to those differentiators? In other words, if you invested a dollar in that work, $5 will come in the door. It's the true secret sauce of your business. It probably accounts for about 15% of your business. The second category is competitive enabling work. This is the work that directly supports that competitive work. So this could be, for example, if you've chosen yourself to make yourself ubiquitously accessible to all your customers, this could be your website technology to make sure your online store is truly convenient and has a great user experience and is easily accessible. That's about another 15% of your work or so. The rest of the work, 50 to 60% of the work in your organization is what we call necessary work. It keeps the lights on. It keeps you out of jail. You don't have to be better at than anybody else, and you should do it as cost effectively as possible. The 30% or 40% of your work that's competitive or competitive enabling, you should do that, organize that work and invest in that work for maximum impact. The best talent, the best tools, the best technologies, and the rest of it should be for maximum efficiency. The least expensive, the most automated, the most repeatable. The problem is when all that work gets mixed up, and when I walk around small businesses, I see people running around with their hair on fire often trying to do all three types of work. Well, of course, what we all know is that the necessary work always wins. It's more immediate. It's more urgent.
Yeah. Right?
And so the competitive work and the competitive daily work get put to the wayside, get set aside, I'll do it later in the week, and of course that never comes. And so you dilute your competitive distinctions because you haven't organized the work well. So the first thing to do is having set your identity, having set your strategic clarity about who you want to be and who you want to serve and how you're going to do it, you have to organize the work accordingly. And those are the two very common processes that small businesses are so reticent to do because they're too busy. And then the problem, of course, is one of the greatest impediments to that is success. So if you've been successful, if the marketplace has rewarded you and you have had a tailwind behind you, and suddenly you went from being a $10 million company to a $30 million company, or a $50 million company to an $80 million company. But really what you are is an $80 million company trapped in the body of a $10 million organization. Like, you grew, but you didn't scale. And now it's mayhem, and you can walk into those places, you can just hear the seams ripping, you know, as people are stretched too thin and confused and the priorities change every day and they don't know who gets to make what decision, and they're frustrated. You as a business owner or a team of people who own the business are thrilled because it looks like success, but it's really masking the fact that you don't really have a sustainable business. And once you hit a headwind or once this wave crests of success, you might find yourself in more trouble than you think.
Wow, that was awesome. And it ties in so nicely to what this show is really all about, you know, that business infrastructure, making sure that you have a system to link your people, your processes, all of the different tools that you use so that as you grow, you can do so in a profitable, but also a very sustainable way.
The word I love that you use, Alicia, is the word system. I wish if your listeners could hear nothing else from you, hear the word, it is a system. Mm-hmm. It's not QuickBooks over here and Payday over here.
Yes.
My phone does this. This is my website person I've outsourced my website to. This is how my shipping and fulfillment places I outsource to UPS. And that collection of activities that might have been great for your garage in your first year, you've long outgrown. And if you don't have an integrated system of how all your data talks to each other, how all of your people understand the end-to-end way you make money, you're already behind.
Wow. So, my next question was going to be, what lesson did you learn as a result of working with that particular company? But I think you've already stated it in so many different ways. But is there one lesson in particular that stands out?
Well, it's the greed one. Mm. So, many businesses aspire to sell, right? They want to exit. They want an exit strategy of some kind. And sometimes they're successful and they come along and get sold. And they're now part of someone else's portfolio of company, but you have to stick around for 4 or 5 years to be part of it. Well, the problem is, you know, your payout, it's going to be based on hitting some certain milestones financially. EBITDA is often one of the metrics that buyers will use to determine, you know, your upside. Well, and I've never seen an acquisition or a merger in my career where the owner who sold and had a stay didn't become EBITDA addicted. Mm. And you will just make very short-term decisions on cost structure. And this is true as you prepare to sell too. You'll start gutting costs and you want your balance sheets to look attractive. You want your sales to look attractive. So you start jerry-rigging things and compromising who you are just to become attractive to a suitor or to maximize your upside after you found a suitor. And I would just say it never works. It never,
ever works. It doesn't. And I'm so glad you're saying that. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to pick up where we're leaving off, which is that this whole notion of being EBITDA addicted. Let's take a quick break. Do you currently have more business than you can handle? Do you need to hire more people but don't have processes documented to train them? Behind the Facade, How to Structure Company Operations for Sustainable Success is a book that explains step by step how to create business infrastructure in your company so that you can hire the right people to do the right things in the right working conditions. It's the world's first book ever written about business infrastructure exclusively for small businesses. Visit behindthefacadebook.com to get your copy today. That's behindthefacadebook.com. And we are back with Ron Carucci. And Ron, before the break, you were sharing an example with us about an adult beverage company that you worked with and how you were able to use processes, one of the key elements of business infrastructure, to help them solve this issue of their identity of strategy and helping them to figure out how to organize their work according to the three categories that you were sharing with us. You also said that one of the biggest lessons you learned as a result of that particular experience and working with them was greed and this idea of being EBITDA addicted. And I'll tell you why that stands out to me, because one thing that I've noticed, especially when I'm in a room with corporate C-level executives, the discussion is, it's almost like they're speaking another language, because it's always about EBITDA. It's always about the numbers. And very rarely is there ever any type of conversation around the operations, making sure that the work that you're doing and the products and services that you're creating and delivering are actually meeting the promises that you've made to your customers. So, you know, I'd like for you to talk about that just a little bit more, because it's something that I've seen. And yes, the numbers are important, but if we aren't careful, it can also lead us to, like you said, making these short-term decisions and might even lead to us compromising our values.
Oh my gosh. I'm there's a big grin on my face here, Lisa, and I mean, you and I have seen this movie 100 times, haven't we?
Yes.
And the good news is I have been in boardrooms and executive team rooms where that is not the conversation, where there is conversation about the customer and the culture and the talent and the financials, right? So there's a balanced dashboard of what we're measuring to determine whether or not we're performing as we want to. It's not just about the numbers. But when you have a VC in the room or a PE firm in the room, or you're trying to get them in the room, or you're struggling, right? It's very easy to pull the financial metric lever aggressively at the expense of other things. And yes, that does begin often a slow death, or sometimes a fast death spiral. I was speaking with a client a couple weeks ago over lunch, who's just taken over as president and CEO of a small retail company. I mean, small, they've got about 200 stores. They want to grow to 500 stores, and it serves a very particular niche customer. And it's doing. He came from a struggling retailer, and this is a company that happens to be doing very, very well. And they're an honest company, and they've been family owned and family run. They've got private equity money behind them now, and they're trying to grow and scale and do all the right things to come into the 21st century but maintain their values.
Yeah.
What was fascinating as our conversation went on about the kinds of changes he's trying to bring and how he's trying to grow them up, but without wrecking the culture and trying to introduce change at the right velocity, all the right things you want to hear from a CEO. And this is a great guy. This is that leader that everybody wants to work for. But over the course of our, you know, hour plus conversation, the thing I never heard from him was, so the target market is a female. And the thing I never heard from him, and it's a very particular, unique niche of women. I never heard about her. I never heard her voice. I never heard her concerns. And this is a company that has the opportunity to make an incredible difference for women through the products they sell. And the opportunities are huge. And he knows that. He knows the branding work they could do to actually really make a great difference for women. And he wants to get there. But in the entire course of our conversation, and I said to him, who is she and why? And what is she saying about that? How does she feel about that? What have you heard from her? How have you gone to the stores and listened to her? Now, granted, he's only been there he only took over well under a year. But the opportunity for her voice to enter the conversation was critical. And he was, you know, so busy entering the company and taking over the reins and learning the company operations, and that like many growing companies of this size, and this is a $100 million plus company, the center of gravity had shifted. And I said, you've got to get out there and listen to her. You've got to find out who she is, what she's saying, what she's angry about. You're stepping into a very profound moment in her life, in her story. If you don't understand that, you'll miss it. And you all sitting around the ivory tower as a bunch of white guys and some women, but mostly guys, talking about what you think that moment is and what you think you're doing for her and how you think you're helping her and why you think she's buying your products is all very interesting. But unless she's at the table, you know, virtually or literally, you can't be sure. And it was a sobering moment. He got it. He took notes. And I know this week he is getting out there into the stores across the country and really understanding who she is and what she's saying and how to incorporate her voice more in the choices they make to grow, even with great success. But this is not a greedy fanatic. This is not that guy. This is a great guy. This is a guy who cares deeply about the people he leads, the values he leads with, the quality with which he does his work, the insights and the intelligence he brings to his role, the incredible level of experience. This is a great leader. And still, the center of gravity had eluded him, right? So it's not just the guys who are, as we call coin operated, right? Driven by money only. it's this is the guy who really cares about a lot of things. So I think, you know, I tell business, put pictures of your target market in your office all over the place. Have their names, have real customers if you can. If you're B2B, get pictures of the company logos. But make sure the center of gravity for everything you do remains rooted outside your walls. The minute the center of gravity, the thing that primarily draws the attention of the organization, shifts inside, you really, that's stage one cancer.
Wow. Well, Ron, we could definitely go on and on talking about this, I'm for sure, but unfortunately we're coming to a close. But before we close, can you share some of the resources that you can recommend? You mentioned a tool where that helps you. I'm assuming that this is some type of a software or something that helps you to organize the work into those three buckets, your competitive work, your competitive enabling work, and the necessary work.
It's not a software issue, but it is a categorizing tool. And if you come to our website, navolit.com, we have a whole set of organization design tools and content there.
Okay.
Awesome. You can come. We have a free book, our free ebook on leading change and how we think about the change in organization and how it matures. If you come to navolit.com, navalent.com/transformation, you can get that free ebook. We've also got some great videos. So if you go on there and look at organization design, just put that in the search bar, a whole bunch of stuff come up, including the categorization of that of your work. And if you can't find what you're looking for there, just reach out and I'd be happy to help you find it and get you however we can help you. Also, find me on Twitter at Ron Carucci or LinkedIn. So stay in touch. If we can help, we'd love to help.
Thank you so much. And one more thing, can you talk a little bit more about your books?
Yeah. So the last book, Rising to Power, was a 10-year study of leaders. So for many leaders, as they rise up, as their businesses grow, as their career grows, and they get more and more influence, we've known for a long time that more than half of them fail in the first 18 months of taking on more responsibility or bigger influence. And as leaders go from working, being in their garage making their product to leading an organization of people making their product, it can be very disorienting. And for some, it's a very difficult transition. And we thought we can do better. We don't have to have half of them fail. So it was a 10-year study. We studied more than 2,700 leaders to understand how do you rise up and stick the landing? How do you make your way to leading an organization, leading a team, and doing it effectively? And so Rising to Power is our playbook for how you do that.
Wow. Well, you definitely are the expert in all of this. And I am so grateful that you took some time out of your schedule to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Alicia, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. And I wish you all the best as you help the small businesses in your world get better. I'm sure that they're all grateful to have you in their corner.
I hope so. Well, now I want to talk to you, the person listening to this right now. Do you have an idea for a new product? Can you use an organization design tool similar to what Ron described to help bring it to market faster than planned? But beware, as Ron has shared with us, about bringing things to market too quickly. Here's a recap of how Ron actually went through that exercise for one of his clients. First, he helped them figure out what does it mean to commercialize for the long term. Beware of innovation driven purely by financial motivation. It's going to cause you to skip some steps, compromise some of your values and your ethics. You really have to think about what is going to set your company apart, your products and your services apart. Make sure you listen to people, your target audience. Do your research, test your products and services before introducing them to the marketplace at large. In other words, do your due diligence. Make sure that you are seen caring about your customers' needs and their wants, and this will surely help you build credibility. I really like how Ron spoke to us about making sure to not skip steps of the process. Good enough is the enemy of survival, but I really like this idea of putting pictures of your target audience around your office, because they are, in fact, your center of gravity. They are the reason that you are in business. And Ron, there were three things that you mentioned, one of which was thoughtfulness, and I didn't capture the other two. Can you tell us those other two really quickly?
Oh my gosh.
You were saying so, and I was like, oh, that was good, but I couldn't write it down quickly enough. You were saying thoughtfulness.
data. So one of them is certainly with data and evidence that there's a need. Alicia,
well, you know what? It's perfectly fine. I'll go back and listen to this, and I'll just make sure that I really make it a point to highlight that in the show notes. I just thought it would be really cool to include it in this recap, but that's perfectly fine. Look, Ron is very well versed in all of this. He's definitely an expert. He's written 8 books, and he's been featured in some of the most prominent business magazines in the world. If you want to learn more about what he's doing at his company, Navalent, definitely reach out to him. The website is navalent.com. That's N like Nancy, A, V like Victor, A, L, E, N like Nancy, T like Tom.com. You can also find Ron on Twitter and LinkedIn. Look for him at Ron Carucci. That's C-A-R-U-C-C-I. We'll have links to all of the information that Ron shared with us today, including links to his 8 books, in the show notes at businessinfrastructure.tv. While you're there, you'll also be able to subscribe to the show as well as download this episode, because it's packed with so much information. I'm sure you're going to want to reference it several times in the near future. While you're there, don't forget to let us know your feedback. Again, you can do all of this at businessinfrastructure.tv. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember, stay focused, be encouraged. This entrepreneurial journey is a marathon and not a sprint. Until the next time.
Thank you for listening to Business Infrastructure, the podcast about curing back office blues with Alicia Butler-Pierre. If you like what you've heard, do us a favor and subscribe, leave a rating and review, and more importantly, share with your colleagues and team members who could benefit from the information. Join us next week for another episode of Business Infrastructure with Alicia Butler-Pierre.